This audio recording is presented by Jews for Judaism. We are dedicated to keeping Jews Jewish. www.jewsforjudaism.ca.
Just a little bit of a background to how this program came to be and alert you about what it is and what it isn't. Basically, this is a program that started with a title. Usually programs start the other way around. You have an idea for what you want to talk about, and then often they ask you to come up with some kind of a snazzy title for the program. I was in Chicago about 4 years ago, or 3 or 4 years ago in Chicago, and this crazy title flew into my head somehow. I don't know why. And I remarked to a friend of mine in Chicago, isn't that cool? .com. And I got a chuckle out of it. And I said, yeah, one day we should do a program based upon the title. And it sort of ruminated for several years, and then tonight's the end point of that process. Now, as you were coming in, a number of people asked me if this is going to be an evening dealing with Jewish meditation. And I suspect maybe the graphic on the flyer created that impression. So the answer is no, this is not a program dealing with Jewish meditation. Okay. So it's interesting that wherever you go in the world, no matter where you travel in the world, you can go to Hong Kong, you can go to Buenos Aires, you can go to Israel, you can go to South Africa, you can go to Europe, anywhere in the world you travel and you meet Jews, the greeting is always exactly the same. No matter where you go, you meet Jews, and we say to each other, Shalom Aleichem. Shalom Aleichem. Peace unto you. Doesn't sound Jewish when you translate it. But Shalom Aleichem, peace to you. Question is, what kind of peace are we wishing people? When we say Shalom Aleichem, are we hoping that the gladiatorial bouts between them and their spouse stop, that somehow there's not going to be any more physical abuse? What are we really talking about when we say Shalom Aleichem? And I think that generally speaking, when we greet each other and we give this blessing of peace unto you, we're really giving people a blessing. And it's wonderful that as soon as we meet people, we begin blessing them. But as soon as we meet people, we give them a blessing that they should have inner peace, that their life should be one of inner peace. And I think that it's important at the beginning this evening for us to clarify what this is and what it isn't. There was an article that appeared in a brand new Jewish magazine, came out a few months ago, called Jewish Spirit. It's actually called The American Jewish Spirit, but we'll call it Jewish Spirit for tonight. And the author of the article is a Rabbi David Goldman, and the article is called Are You Spiritual? Are You Spiritual? And the basis of the article was a poll that was published by Time Magazine in October of 2004, and the poll was a way of determining whether or not you were spiritual. So Rabbi Goldman took this test, and he scored a miserable 2 out of a possible 20. And when they gave you your description, like they gave you a paragraph describing what your number meant, so Rabbi Goldman was told that he was someone highly skeptical and resistant to developing spiritual awareness. Now, he was puzzled by this. He's a very spiritual person. He's a professional spiritual person. And he couldn't understand at first why he got a 2 out of 20. And then he started looking at the questions that they were asking on this Time Magazine poll. And here were some of them. Awareness of the passage of time. Do people see you as absent-minded? Those are the kinds of questions that they were seeking. And Rabbi Goldman came to realize that they were really testing for flakiness more than spirituality. So it's very obvious that if you're trying to pursue and explore spirituality, a faulty definition of spirituality will be very, very harmful. And so too with the topic for tonight of inner peace. A faulty understanding will not at all help us. Before he married his daughter, I was a big fan of Woody Allen. And in one of his first collections of essays, or short stories, that was put together in a book called Getting Even, he has a chapter of his fractured Hasidic tales. And Woody Allen tells a story about a man who journeyed to Chelm in order to seek the advice of Rabbi Ben Kaddish, the holiest of all 9th century rabbis and perhaps the greatest nudge of the medieval era. Rabbi, the man asked, where can I find peace? The chassid surveyed him and said, quick, look behind you. The man turned around, and Rabbi Ben Kaddish smashed him in the back of the head with a candlestick. Is that peaceful enough for you? He chuckled, adjusting his yarmulke. Now today, unfortunately, what we find is a bizarre fascination with magical shortcuts to inner peace that include everything from wearing a particular kind of red string, to drinking special energized water, to calling 1-800-PSYCHIC. And unfortunately, that's how many people are pursuing inner peace. Rabbi Adin Steinsaltz has for us a very important caveat, a very important warning when it comes to thinking about this issue, this topic. He observes that today there is a growth industry in helping people overcome stress and anxiety, and people often view relaxation and tranquility as one of life's ultimate goals. But what is peace? So our rabbis teach, a very famous teaching of the rabbis, that God found no vessel but peace that can contain all of life's blessings. There's no blessing, there's nothing like peace that is able to contain all of life's blessings. Peace is a vessel that is able to contain blessing. But unfortunately, peace can also be an empty vessel that contains nothing at all. And Rabbi Steinsaltz advises us to be aware of the fact that peace with no content is an empty vessel that is meaningless, and that when the pressure and tension are gone, even though the pressure and the tension are gone, but if nothing positive has taken their place, this is ultimately decadent. It's ultimately just decadent. And he quotes an interesting verse in the book of Koheles, the book of Ecclesiastes, written by King Solomon, who wrote, better off a living dog than a dead lion. Better off being a living dog than a dead lion. We all know that a lion is much greater than a dog. Rabbi Steinsaltz explains that as long as our life has activity, as long as there's progress, as long as we're filling it up with something, as long as there's a struggle, even a struggle for the bare existence of a dog, that's better than the empty tranquility of death. And so he tells us that the question is not so much how to escape struggle, not so much how to escape the struggle of life, but rather what form to give our struggle and on what level to wage the struggle. I want to share with you a very fascinating commentary by Rabbeinu Yonah, who was a Jewish sage who lived about 1,000 years ago. And he comments on a very famous teaching that the rabbis have. Many of you know this teaching, that our forefather Abraham was subjected to 10 trials. Abraham had to go through 10 trials, and we normally understand that each of these trials built, and they grew successively more difficult. And so therefore, everyone who reads this statement of the rabbis, when they try to order what are the 10 trials, has as the final test of Abraham the Akedah, the trial where he had to take his only begotten son, Isaac, and bring him to Mount Moriah and begin to sacrifice him on the top of the mountain. There God is calling Abraham to the greatest sacrifice, the most incredible test possible. It's almost absurd in what is required of Abraham. And yet Rabbeinu Yonah says that the binding of Isaac was only the ninth test. It was only the ninth test. Everybody who reads this commentary scratches their head and wonders, so what was the tenth test? What can possibly top the test of having to take your only child that God promised to you and bringing him up to the mountain and sacrificing him? What could possibly not be anticlimactic to that test? And Rabbeinu Yonah says that the final test of Abraham was the test of when he came back from Mount Moriah and he found that his wife, his beloved wife Sarah, had died, and he was now required to deal with some very unsavory people to try to purchase a burial plot. And therefore, the final trial of Abraham is the trial of having to handle and deal with the people from Ephron to try and purchase the Maras HaMachpelah in Hebron. Now you wonder, is that really more difficult, just having to deal with difficult business people and buying a burial plot? Is that really more difficult than sacrificing your son? So the point here is very, very important psychologically. You see, we all harbor this illusion that we're going to have to struggle through life. We all accept that life is going to be difficult and there will be struggles and difficulties. And yet many of us labor under the misassumption that at some point we're going to be able to sort of kick back, retire, live out our golden years, you know, just get a chance to live life fully and more meaningfully, and not have to go through all the grind and all the burden and all the difficulties. We could appreciate that Abraham, after nine trials, and the final trial so difficult, having to take his only begotten son and bring him to Mount Moriah, and almost having to sacrifice him, we can imagine that Abraham, deep down inside, would say, you know what, genug schon, it's enough. I've already put in my dues. What more can anyone expect of me? Now it's time to come home and I can dwell in tranquility, have a nice, easy retirement, and live out my golden years. And God sends him this difficult situation of having to deal with these unsavory people and purchase a plot for his wife. It's not the hassle of buying the burial plot that's a trial. The trial is getting over his very understandable expectation and hope that, you know what, I can live out the last few years of my life in quiet. And the Torah's answer is no. There's never downtime. There's never quiet time. And that we never stop the process of life. As the famous rabbis, many of them said, being a Jew is like being a bird. And if you stop flapping your wings, you ultimately fall down. So what is inner peace? What is inner peace? Ultimately, we're going to see tonight that equanimity doesn't mean that our struggles come to an end. That is not the definition of inner peace. But rather, inner peace is an inner quality that equips us to handle those struggles. Inner peace is a quality of our soul and personality that we develop that allows us to navigate the difficult times of our lives. A calm soul is centered. A calm soul is balanced. And a calm soul rides on an even keel, And regardless of what is happening to that soul, the calm soul is able to maintain its balance. A person that has this kind of equilibrium is a person that ultimately is in control of their minds. And that control gives a person a tremendous amount of energy and freedom to be able to encounter life with bounce and zest and grace and joy. Let me share with you a few stories. And part of the difficulty I had with tonight's program was there are so many billions of stories and so many ways of developing this talk that I realized it's not really a talk, it should be a course. So maybe in the future down the road we'll do that. But I'll share just a few short anecdotes about what kind of energy and equilibrium we're able to bring into some of the most difficult parts of life. You know, you can always tell a lot about a person, especially how they've gone through life, by the way they handle death. You can tell a tremendous about someone, tremendous amount about them, by seeing how they encounter their last moments, their last days or weeks on earth. Rabbi Yisrael Salanter, who was a great Jewish ethical teacher of the 19th century, was at the last stages of his life. He was in a home with one other person, and he realized he was soon about to pass away. How did he spend his last moments? He pulled this person over, and he spent his last minutes trying to calm this person down. That I know you're going to be alone in a house with a dead body. It's probably a little bit scary. But he spent his time trying to reassure this person that everything would be okay. He has nothing to worry about. That's someone who can only take his mind off his own imminent death if he has a tremendous amount of inner peace. Rabbi Yosef Chaim Sonnenfeld was one of the great leaders of the Jewish community in Israel during the British Mandate. And because of health reasons, his doctors urged him to leave the old city of Jerusalem and to live on the outskirts where it was a little bit fresher air, there weren't as many industries, there weren't as much pollution, it was much brighter. It was much nicer to live outskirts of Jerusalem. And he also came to the last moments of his life, and he asked his family to bring him back to the old city of Jerusalem. And they were surprised, because it would be better for his health to stay outside the big city. And he confessed to one of his family members that he didn't want to die outside the old city, because he realized that the Chevra Kedisha, the Jewish Burial Society, would have to carry him quite far. And he didn't want to have to burden these people. So he was able to see past his own imminent demise, whatever normal panic that might set in most people, and he was able to be focused and to place others first. There was once a student of the Chazon Ish. The Chazon Ish was one of the great leaders of Jewry during the 1930s to the 1950s. And the student of the Chazon Ish, his name was Rav Moshe. He had a printing press. He owned a small printing press. And one day he wakes up and he sees that down the street from his printing press, someone else opened up another printing press. So he went over to this man and he welcomed him in a very friendly way. And he offered him advice on how he would be able to grow his business. And he offered him help. If any, he needed any parts or any machinery, feel free to come by. And he blessed this person that his business should be successful. It's not the kind of reaction that most of us would have to someone who we might see as trying to ruin our business. On December 11th, 1995, Malden Mills, famous mill that produced, I think, some of the high-tech sweaters that we wear, Malden Mills burnt to the ground. You can imagine that the owner of this company would be distraught and have to give his 3,000 employees the bad news that, "I'm sorry, Rabosai, that we're out of business." And yet, Aaron Feuerstein, a religious Jew, kept all 3,000 employees on full-time payroll with full benefits. It cost him millions and millions of dollars. And he kept them on these benefits and on payroll for over 3 months until the factories could be rebuilt. It takes a certain amount of inner balance for a person to see life and react like that. One last vignette. We're told that after the Second Temple was destroyed, some of the rabbis are walking on the Temple Mount, and they saw some foxes that just came out of the former site of the Holy of Holies. And all the rabbis were weeping. It's horrible. You're seeing these dirty animals hanging out and romping around our Holy of Holies. And Rabbi Akiva, who was with them, started to smile and laugh. And the other rabbis couldn't understand, "What are you laughing about? This is the most horrible thing you could imagine." Rabbi Akiva said, "You know what? There were prophecies in the Bible that foretold the destruction of the temple. But there are also prophecies in the Bible that foretell the rebuilding of the temple." Rabbi Akiva said, "You know what? I see that the negative prophecies have been fulfilled. I feel very confident that the positive prophecies of rebuilding will also be fulfilled. And I have a certain good feeling about that." Now, why are we here tonight? I believe that Judaism at its core is not simply a religion, but that Judaism is a technology that was given by the manufacturer to ensure optimal product usage and satisfaction. The rabbis teach in the Midrash the following, and the wording is very important. The rabbis teach, "Lo nitna Torah ella litzaref bahem et abriot." The Torah was only given, in order to refine us and in order to perfect us, to purify us. And therefore, Judaism, at its core, is a program for personal growth. It's a program for personal growth. And therefore, everything about it is there to build us, and the foundation of personal growth, the foundation of spiritual growth, obviously is going to be a settled, calm, peaceful mind. I'm going to share with you a story that I witnessed quite a few years ago. It was when I was a student at Yeshiva University. I think this goes back to approximately 1973. It's a long time ago. And at Yeshiva University, it was pretty funny actually, a phys ed requirement. No one really took it seriously. And you had a few options. You can't have much physical education in Washington Heights. There's no football field. So many of us chose the karate program. Of course, we never showed up. We would put our name down, and the guy would pass us because we had more important things to do. But the director of the martial arts program was a very, very special person, a brilliant genius named Chaim Sober. Chaim Sober was also a professor of Hebrew at Yeshiva University, but he was one of the top-ranked martial artists in the world. And every year, they would put on a martial arts exhibition. Now that, we would go to. The classes every week, we would skip out on. But the exhibition was quite interesting. And they would do things like not only break boards and break bricks, but I remember seeing Chaim Sober tapping a garden rock with his hand very slightly and exploding into pieces. You can imagine it's the kind of show that people came to. But I want to share with you what was for me the highlight of this demonstration. Professor Sober had about 5 or 6 primary students, and one was part of a couple. It was a married couple. The woman was not even 5 feet tall and probably didn't break 90 pounds on a scale. And she was going to demonstrate a technique called rooting. R-O-O-T-I-N-G. Rooting. And she planted herself in the ground. And after a few moments of meditation, they brought over the 6th biggest zhlubs at Yeshiva University. The 6th biggest bulvans. These are people, they're not that big actually because we're Jews, but they were people that were 6 feet tall, over 250 pounds. These were big guys, football player size men. And they were challenged to try to budge her. Not throw her across the room. They were challenged to budge her. And I watched in amazement as these 6 very large gentlemen could not move her a half an inch. Now you can imagine that had a very profound impact on my life. I'm not sure how, but it had a very profound impact. What I'm hoping to do in the next part of the evening is share with you what I believe is Judaism's approach for building for ourselves this kind of solid foundation for our lives. How do we build a foundation that will root us in life and give us the kind of inner calm and equanimity that will allow us to face a lot of the difficulties and challenges of life? So I want to share with you a teaching of the Chazon Ish. Again, he was a great rabbi who lived in the first half of the 20th century. And he remarked in one of his letters, he said the following. I'm paraphrasing what he said. He says, when you live according to the light of truth, when you live according to reality, when you live according to reality and truth, he says there will be no sadness. There will be no sadness for such a person. And I think what he's saying is that there is real contentment. There is real contentment in life comes when you know that you're doing what you're supposed to be doing. If you're living your life with the knowledge, the deep knowledge, that what you're doing is exactly what you're supposed to be doing, there's a tremendous amount of inner strength that you get from this knowledge. Now, what should we be doing? That's the $64,000 question. What should we be doing with our lives? And the answer is that we are to realize that we are engaged in a building project. That is the fundamental truth of life. The recognition that we are engaged in a building project. What is that building project? So we go back to the very beginning of the Bible, where human beings are first created, and God introduces the creation of man with a very strange preface. God says, Na'aseh Adam b'tzalmenu. Let us create man in our image. And obviously, everyone with an eye to text asked the same question. Let us create man? Who is God speaking to? Who's the we? Who's the us? And there are many answers. God might have been speaking to the angels. Or maybe it was the royal editorial we, like the Queen of England says, oh, what shall we have for dinner? There are many answers. But one of the most profound answers has been offered by some of the Hasidic teachers. And they say the following. Who was God speaking to? God was speaking to the man, the human being, and all human beings who are about to be created. When God wants to create you, God recognizes he cannot do it alone. Every elephant in the world is created fully elephant. An elephant does not become more of an elephant as it gets older. It might get bigger, but it doesn't become more of an elephant. every flower, every insect, everything in the universe, God was able to create directly, unilaterally. And yet when it comes to human beings, God understands that he cannot fully create a human being. God can give us the raw ingredients. God can give us potential. God can give us a body and a soul. But ultimately, who we are is a product of what we do with those raw ingredients. Who we become as human beings is ultimately up to us. God cannot create you. You ultimately create yourself. We start off life as pure potential. And actualizing that potential is who we are. Now, the journey does not cause happiness. The journey is happiness and fulfillment itself. You know, there's a Hebrew word, sameach, happiness. And the rabbis point out that etymologically and grammatically, the word sameach is related to the Hebrew word tzomeach. The sin and the tzadi can be interchanged. Sameach means growing, growth, flowering, blooming. And they teach us here that there's only happiness where there is growth. There's only sameach when there's tzameach. You know, there's a very popular book. It's actually very ancient. It's become very popular in the past few years. It's called the Perek Shira. It's an ancient, ancient Jewish book. They have now beautiful editions with pictures of every single bird and natural object in the creation of the world. It's quite a beautiful text. And it gives you the special song that is sung by every creation on the planet. You see different birds and different insects and different creatures and the sun and the moon and the stars. But there's something missing from this book. Adam is not mentioned. The human being is not included in the Perek Shira. And the reason is because each of us has to write our own song. There isn't a predetermined song for every human being. And that is our job as we go through life to ultimately create who we are and write our own song. In Hebrew, the word shalom, peace, is again related to the word shalem, which means complete, whole, perfect. The idea of peace is very much related to the idea of becoming whole, becoming complete, becoming perfect. We're able to become people that are at peace when we embrace this journey of perfecting ourselves. And this ultimately was the first directive given to the first Jew, to Abraham. Abraham was told, Lech Lecha, go for you, go for yourself, journey to ultimately get to you. That's what the journey is toward, getting to who you are. And what our rabbis teach us is that there's an inner sense of positivity, an inner sense of tremendous peace and calm when you are moving along this path that leads to yourself. Ultimately, inner peace is not the goal of life. Inner peace is not the goal of life, but it's the byproduct of working towards your life's goal. And we know that working toward a goal can be extremely energizing. Some of you might remember the movie Bridge Over the River Kwai, about some British prisoners of war that were captured by the Japanese, and they're given this assignment to build this bridge, and they embraced the project. I mean, it was crazy. They really should have been working against this project, but we know that we need meaning and direction in our lives. Viktor Frankl wrote a very seminal piece about man's search for meaning that spoke about the people who were able to survive the concentration camps intact were people that were able to focus their lives around some direction and purpose. And so these British prisoners of war embraced this construction project. And the crazy ending of the film is that the British Army finally comes to blow up this bridge. And the British soldiers who were working on it, no, they wanted to save this bridge. And yet the opposite is totally demoralizing. We know that when the Egyptians wanted to demoralize the Jews, our rabbis tell us, they had us build the store cities in Pitom and Ramses. All the work projects that the Egyptians made the Jewish people do were on places that were prone to earthquakes. Because the Egyptians specifically wanted to destroy our morale and destroy our sense of inner peace. Now, it's vital that we recognize that difficulties are necessary for growth. If we want to grow, difficulties are necessary. All of you know that when you go to the gym, what is it that builds muscles? Resistance. Resistance is necessary for growth. And this is ultimately the Jewish idea of Satan. The word Satan in the Bible means opposition. It means obstacle. It means roadblock. And the rabbis teach us that Satan, was one of the greatest blessings that God ever gave humanity. Because ultimately, without friction, without obstacles, without roadblocks, without challenges, our lives can go nowhere. We would ultimately choke in a world that had no difficulties or no challenges. If you remember the film The Matrix, so we know there were actually two matrixes. The first matrix that was constructed by the robot computers to enslave mankind was a matrix that was a perfect life that had no problems, no difficulties, everything was just smooth sailing. Everyone smiled all the time. No difficulties. You could eat all the chocolate cake in the world and you wouldn't gain a pound. And we were told that humanity rebelled against this matrix. They hated this kind of matrix. It would drive them nuts. And they demanded a world, a matrix that was constructed like the world we live in now that has challenges, difficulties, obstacles that we're able to overcome. And that's what happens. When you meet an obstacle in life, when you meet a roadblock, that's an opportunity for you to climb over that roadblock, to climb over that obstacle. And in the process of climbing over it, you build your spiritual muscles and you create who you are. We all know that the greatest joys in life are experienced when we move ahead against these kinds of resistance. Anyone that went through a program to get into shape or to lose weight and accomplishes has struggled, it hasn't been easy, and they feel wonderful when they've managed to overcome those obstacles and succeed. We know that anyone who was able to excel in a difficult class where they had to work very hard, there's a tremendous feeling of satisfaction when we're able to do that. Anyone that's worked hard on a community cause and had to go to meetings and schlep and work and deal with the most difficult problems knows that there's no feeling of accomplishment and joy as someone who's able to work and succeed on a project like that. Ask any parent in the world, what is your greatest joy in life? And what will parents tell you? My greatest joy in the world are my kids. And ask those same parents, what is the greatest pain in your life? My kids. One last point here. The ultimate conflict is not outside of us, it's inside of us. The ultimate conflict is the tension between our bodies and our souls. And that's the way we were set up on purpose. And human perfection, shleimut, wholeness, is not achieved when the soul ignores the body or escapes from the body. And human perfection is not achieved when the soul caves into the body or when the soul is co-opted by the body. We're told, on the contrary, that we were put on this world for our soul to be able to educate and teach our bodies. And then ultimately, our goal is to get our bodies to work for our souls. Our goal is to enlist our bodies in the causes of our souls. The rabbis use the imagery of a rider on a horse. The horse is our body. The horse is very much into superficial pleasures. The horse wants to eat, and the horse wants to run, and the horse wants to sleep, and the horse wants to do things that are simple and physical and superficial and immediately pleasurable. A horse has no concept of delayed gratification. On the other hand, the rider is what directs the horse. The rider has direction and meaning and purpose and goals. The truth is that our riders, that's who we really are, that's our soul. Our riders really have a big agenda in life. Our riders would like to be generous and do acts of kindness. Our riders really do. Our soul loves to be able to help people. But when we get a call from the UJA campaign, how many of us are thrilled and say, "What? 1 minute, I'm going to run and get my checkbook and I'm going to..." Now, I suspect that many of us might run to the ice part of our freezer and grab some ice cream. The horse is going to run and gallop to get pleasure. So the goal of life is to somehow train our souls, our bodies, to say, "You know what? I want to put the same amount of energy and passion into things that are more spiritual. If I knew that I had a lottery ticket worth $5 million, I might even exceed the speed limit in getting to try and pick up my check. I'll be very excited to get there. But I usually don't have the same kind of zeal and passion and energy when I'm riding to the synagogue in the morning to pray or to study." So what we're told is we have this tension, internal tension, between our body and our soul. And the goal of life, and it's a long, hard struggle, is to work ultimately to get our body to do what the soul ultimately wants. Now we're going to move on to a second level of rooting. A second level of rooting, which goes beyond the truth of having peace when you know that you are doing what you should be doing. And this second level of rooting brings us to a place and extends to the vital idea that the world is functioning according to its plan. It's one thing to know that I am doing what I should be doing. But a second major issue is the knowledge that, you know what? The world is functioning as it should be functioning. The world is going according to a plan. And this brings us to the fundamental ideas of Judaism. We all throw them around like platitudes, but we often don't really think about what they mean. Ask anyone, what is the first of the Ten Commandments? It's in every synagogue up on the wall. We learn it in Hebrew school. If we know anything as Jews, we know the Ten Commandments. And the first one, "I am the Lord your God." And in all opinion polls, the vast majority of North Americans give their assent to the belief in God. "Sure, I believe in God. Of course there's a God." This second level of rooting takes us to the place where we have to begin living our lives where that is a reality, where we understand not only that there's a God that exists, but living our lives with an understanding that God runs the world. That God runs the world. Everyone knows the most basic Jewish prayer. Shema Yisrael, Adonai Eloheinu, Adonai Echad. God is one. God is responsible for everything on this planet and in the universe. Everything that exists, exists only because God wills it to exist. And what this second level of rooting calls us to recognize is that we have to live by our faith, not just have it as a mental assent that we check off on a list, sure, I believe there's a God. But to really explore, what does that mean? You could get a 4-year-old or a 6-year-old or a 9-year-old to say, yeah, I believe there's a God. But to be able to integrate that idea into your life on a real level and on a daily level takes a lifetime. And this is the Hebrew and Jewish concept called bitachon. Bitachon ultimately is an extension of the idea of faith. And bitachon means trust. And bitachon means reliance. It's an incredibly powerful concept. And it's ultimately a relationship that we develop with God, where we begin to assume, as Mick Jagger sang, you can't always get what you want, but somehow you'll find, if you try, you'll get what you need. I didn't realize until I thought about the song that Mick Jagger was a great Baal Musar. But that's ultimately the idea here. The idea is that we go through life and we recognize I may not get every single thing in life that I want. But I have an abiding trust in the fact that God will provide me with what I need to get through life. Once we recognize that we are simply passengers on this plane, and that we're passengers on the flight of life, and we know that the captain is fully capable, and we know that the captain knows what he's doing, and we know that the captain has our best interests in mind, I will not feel compelled to go through life as a backseat driver. And nothing will rob our inner peace and inner calm if I feel that I have to run the world. I'm the one that's in charge of the world. Knowing that God is in charge and that God loves us and that God only has our good in mind, ultimately, takes a tremendous amount of pressure off of me and you. So we will work. We will work to shape our lives as we think they should go. That's normal. And yet we'll be fully prepared to accept whatever occurs. Now let me share with you an important thing to remember. That to achieve this kind of recognition and to achieve the resultant energy that comes with it isn't easy. It requires a tremendous amount of work. I'll just share with you that this past week, a wonderful program started here in Toronto that's run by a Rabbi Kellerman from Israel. He comes in now once a month to Toronto, and there's a group of men and women that are working on acquiring faith. And it's going to be a 3-year program. 3 years, where they have assignments every day, studies every day, meditations every day, journaling every day. Every day for 3 years, just to work on acquiring this attribute of faith. It does not come easily. And they're only going to get to the first level after the 3 years. You know, when Rav Moshe, I mentioned before, the student of the Chazon Ish, recognized that someone opened up a printing shop right down the block from him, he was a little bit taken aback at first. He didn't immediately run to this guy's shop and offer him his congratulations and assistance. But as soon as he was taken aback, he went and he took his teacher's book. The Chazon Ish wrote a book called Emuna Ubitachon, Faith and Trust. He studied it for many hours. And then he came to the deep appreciation that God will provide for him. and that God allots for each of us the amount of money that we need for each year. And he came to a place in his life where he appreciated the fact that this man's store will not take away 1 cent from what he will be getting from God. And once he recognized that this person was ultimately not going to affect his livelihood at all, he even came to appreciate, you know what this guy is going to do? He's going to make my life easier. He's going to take some of the burden off of me. I won't have to be working so hard to service all these people that need printing jobs. Go into a Kinko's or a Print 3 someday and see how they run around crazy at 5 o'clock. It's not easy. A lot of demands on people. So this Rav Moshe realized, you know what? I'm going to work. I'm not going to have to go as crazy next year. I'm thankful for this guy for making my life easier. I want to conclude by sharing with you one final piece that I really am frustrated with. I didn't develop enough inner calm about this last piece of the presentation. And it's because I realized here that I need another 15 or 20 hours of your time. What I tried to develop up until now were some of the general foundations. But the truth is, when we look at the rest of Judaism, everything else in Judaism comes to consolidate these points. The rest of Judaism is there to help us really bring them into our lives and consolidate them and learn them on deeper and deeper levels. Shabbat, for example. Shabbat is a day that we call a day of peace. Shabbat is a day where we feel, as we come into that seventh day, that the past is gone. Everything that I was working on, it's finished already. I don't bring one worry or concern into the Shabbat. All my work is finished. I don't spend a moment on Shabbat thinking about next week's or next day's plans. It's a day of pure, delicious peace, where we're able to say, I don't need to work 7 days a week to support myself. I can work 5, 6 days, and I'm still going to survive. God will take care of me. We know that when the Jews went through the desert after they left Egypt, we know that every single one of their catastrophes was caused by a lack of faith, a lack of bitachon. What was the golden calf all about? The golden calf was not primarily an issue of idolatry. It was idolatry. But the prime issue, the prime problem, was one of panic. They thought Moses is supposed to come back after a certain amount of time. And wait a second, he's not back, where is he? And they panicked and they freaked out and they needed to do something desperate. And that desperation drove them to build a golden calf. We're told that they were about to enter the land of Israel and they sent in spies, and the spies come back and say, hey, the people in the land of Israel, they're pretty big guys, they're strong. And the Jewish people in the desert again freaked out. They couldn't handle this challenge. They lost their faith. They lost their trust. And they said, we can never go. We'll never do it. We'll never conquer them. And they started to cry and weep. And because of that, we're told, they had to spend 40 years in the desert. The 40 years in the desert was not because of the golden calf. It was because they just simply didn't get it. They didn't get it. After God performed miracles in Egypt and at the Red Sea, and provided them with their food every day from heaven, the manna, and sent all these miracles to take care of them, and provide for them, and do everything for them. They didn't get it, and they didn't realize that obviously this God is going to bring them into the Promised Land. And so they were forced to spend 40 years in the desert in a spiritual boot camp, where for 40 years they had to learn to trust God. And every year, we celebrate these 40 years in the desert with the holiday of Sukkot. We remember those 40 years of boot camp. And then we leave our homes. We come to realize our houses, our homes, our cars, our jobs, our doctors don't provide us with ultimate security. We leave our secure homes. We go out into a little bit of a hut, into a booth for 7, 8 days, and we live there intimately with God, just me and God, without any of the props that we usually build to make us feel more secure. Prayer is an entire discipline where we again develop this intimacy with God. And the challenge of prayer, as we all know, is that we're trying to pray and the most crazy thoughts pop into my brain. How did that get there? Trying to talk to God, trying to read from a prayer book, I'm trying to just express myself. And in the middle of this experience, I'm thinking, did I turn off the stove? Did I lock the door? So our rabbis tell us an amazing strategy. Not just in terms of dealing with prayer, but in dealing with our inner peace. The Chafetz Chaim told a story about a father who had a fruit stand. And he took the fruit one day and he schleps his son with him into the city. And he says to the son, you know, I have to go into the city to get something. You watch the fruit stand for a little while. And this 14-year-old boy is watching the fruit stand. And all of a sudden, this gang of four or five tough kids come over, start pushing him around, start grabbing the fruit. They knock him down to the floor. And they grab all the fruit and they run away. And the father comes back an hour later and sees his son laying on the floor, sitting there crying. All the fruit is gone. And the father says, what happened? And he says, you wouldn't believe it, Daddy. They came, these five people, they started pushing him and they grabbed all the fruit. And the father started screaming at him. And he couldn't believe it. What are you screaming at me for? They were grabbing all the fruit away. And the father says, you know what? They were grabbing. You could have grabbed too. You're in the middle of praying and you're being distracted by some crazy thought that grabs your attention. So we have the ability to say, I'm grabbing some attention back. When something disturbs our inner peace, we have the ability to grab inner peace back. The Shemitah, every 7 years, the Jews living in the land of Israel were not allowed to plant. They had to leave their land fallow, leave it for the poor to pick up. People were going to say, what are we going to do? What are we going to eat? We're not going to plant for a whole year? You know, today, people in the academic profession have the great blessing of a sabbatical year. Imagine a whole year, I don't have to schlep, I don't have to work, I don't have to grade papers, I don't have to write proposals. I could spend a whole year growing as an individual. I could spend a whole year doing research. The professor on sabbatical is not spending the year going bowling or watching soap operas. The professor, though, is doing what they really love. If I have this field, I get a whole year now to study and do research. So as Jews, God says to us, you know what? It's not enough that you have one day out of seven, a Shabbos, where you get a chance to be with yourself and be with your family and grow spiritually. You need more than that. We're going to give you an entire year, once every 7 years, nada, nothing. You're just going to work on growing spiritually. And we're going to say, but what are we going to eat during that year? The next year there'll be nothing. And God says to us, don't worry. I will make sure that you have a bumper crop. You'll get twice as much. You'll have enough to eat. It's an experiment. It's an exercise in developing trust. Torah study, the foundation activity of every Jew. Here I would need years to share with you all of the Torah study ideas on developing inner peace. Just share two with you. Number one. Our sages teach us in Ethics of the Fathers, one of the most beautiful and important pieces of information that the Talmud has. How do you become a happy person? How do you really become happy? The answer is, you have to learn to enjoy what you have. If you focus your life on what you don't have, you will never be happy. So if you want to do a very important experiment, to do it when you go home tonight, do it right now. Make a list of the five things that you think you need to really make you ultimately happy. Just put them down on a piece of paper, either now or later tonight. Five things that you really feel that you need to make you fully happy. When you do that, take another sheet of paper and write down the five greatest blessings that you have right now, this minute. What are the five greatest blessings that you have right now, this minute? It's an incredibly important thing to do, by the way, to just think about what your blessings are. If we don't think about them, we'll never appreciate them. And then to look at these two lists and ask yourself, which list has better things on it? Which list has more important things on it? And then to spend the next month, spend 5 minutes a day, or 10 minutes if you really want to. Spend a few minutes every day looking at your list and contemplating those things that you have right now and thinking about them and really appreciating them. Do we really ever sit and appreciate the fact that we have eyes and that we can see? Remember when I was in Israel back in 1979, I woke up in my cousin's house. I was spending Shabbat there, and I didn't realize that they were going to turn off the lights on Friday night. And I woke up, and it was pitch black in the living room where I was sleeping. They had the plastic trees, whatever it's called, over the windows. There were no lights anywhere in the house. And I woke up 27 years old, and I said, "Ah, I'm blind!" It was the most horrible experience of my life. I literally thought I was blind. I sat there in bed crying. What am I going to do now? I can't finish rabbinical school. I don't even know what I'm going to do with my life. It was horrible. And then I had the crazy idea of running over to the window and clawing back the plastic trees that I saw. Thank God there was a moon, there was a street light. And I spent hours after that laying in bed and saying to myself, boy, I will never take that for granted again. I will never, ever, ever take my eyesight for granted. And we know how long that lasted, right? Because I didn't continue the meditation. I didn't continue that exercise. But if we don't pause to appreciate what we have, we won't appreciate what we have. I'm going to share with you one very short story. My first teacher of Talmud has a sister who was severely handicapped. And when I was in rabbinical school, a close friend of mine, who is now a rabbi in Montreal, set me up to go out with this woman. We went out on a date. And it ended up that we weren't meant for each other, but we became very close friends. She at one point despaired of ever getting married. She was contemplating dating Jewish men that were not into Judaism, and then thinking about even dating people who were not Jewish. It was very, very difficult for her. And then she had a miracle happen, a tremendous miracle, and she met, under miraculous circumstances, a blind rabbi. And they married. Now, this is a woman that has her spine fused, severe polio as a child. I was living in Philadelphia when they got married. And I went in from Philadelphia to the wedding. And at the wedding, I ran into someone else from Philadelphia. And I said, "Oh, I didn't know that you knew these people getting married." He said, "I don't know them." "So why are you here?" I said to him. He says, "Because I'm getting married next year, and my fiancé and I came in from Philadelphia to look at wedding halls. So we came in to see this wedding hall." And we then go maybe a half hour later into the chuppah, and my friend decided she would walk down to the chuppah. It took her about 40 minutes to walk without her wheelchair to get married. You can imagine there was not a dry eye at this chuppah, at this wedding. About 3 hours later, I meet this guy from Philadelphia again. And I said to him, "You're still here?" I said, "So what do you and your fiancé think about this hall?" So he smiled and said to me, "You know what?" He said, "You see a wedding like this, and you say to yourself, who gives a damn about what the wedding hall looks like? How absurd. It's got the right colors, it's got the right this." He said he came to understand at that wedding what is really important in life. Another teaching of the Talmud and our rabbis is that our outside influences our inside. There's a very, very deep relationship between our inside and our outside. Now, this is something that psychologists only realized fairly recently. If you study neuro-linguistic programming, you learn some of the techniques of how you can actually bring about certain psychological states by how you actually carry yourself and act. But the rabbis taught us centuries and centuries ago that a person is formed, their inside is formed by what they do. So Nachmanides, for example, tells us that you can become calm, you can become very much at peace inside by acting calm. If you speak quietly, you'll become a more calm person. It's pretty easy. It's a shortcut. You put on the looks of calmness, you put on the looks, the posture of someone that's calm, you will become calm. Rav Nachman of Breslov told us that Yishuv Hadat, this is the Hebrew term for a mind that is calm and a mind that's settled. So Rav Nachman of Breslov said, Yishuv Hadat, a settled mind, requires yeshiva, sitting. One of the most important steps is to sit relaxed, to sit and spend a few minutes just relaxing. How many people that you know, spend 10, 15 minutes every day just sitting quietly and relaxing? I remember that one of my favorite artists when I was growing up was Frank Zappa from the Mothers of Invention. And in one of his songs, he asked his listeners about parents, do they ever let their children see them sitting and thinking? It's an amazing thing. A lot of people get frightened when they see their parents thinking. What are they thinking? You know, going to trade that kid in. But it's an amazing, amazing experience that we cheat ourselves of. And Rav Nachman of Breslov says that one of the most important things for beginning to cultivate inner calmness is just to sit calmly and relax. Hitbodedut is the next level. It's not. It goes beyond that. This is pre-hitbodedut. Two more, and it will end. One of the Ten Commandments that we only think is for kids. Kibud av v'aim. Treating our parents with respect and honor. You know, we all wonder, why is it that on those two sets of tablets, you have honoring your parents on the first side? We know that the second tablets have all these commandments dealing with how I relate to other people. And the first set of tablets talks about my relationship with God. So the fifth commandment of honor your father, that's just sticking into the next set. Maybe have 4 and 6, we have to have 5 and 5. It wasn't done just for the symmetry. None of us would have died if it had 6 and 4. So we know that we can learn a tremendous amount about our relationship with God from our relationship to our parents. And children don't really appreciate this. As we get older, we can begin to appreciate this. And that's why this commandment is not just for kids. Think about the fact that when you're growing up, your parents take care of you. And you come to rely on them. I realized recently that I relied on my parents till pretty late in life. Even now, when I need certain things, I know where I can go. But like everything in life, we often take the most precious things for granted. So this commandment says, don't take your parents for granted. Think about the fact that these are people that took care of you. They were consistent. They would do anything for you. They had your best interests in mind. Parents would walk through fire for their children. And when we understand that, we can begin to appreciate, you know what? And we have a parent in heaven who is much, much, much more able to take care of us. And one last tool that I want to share with you for acquiring inner peace. This might be a bit of a shortcut. And this is the idea that if we try to give other people inner peace, we will be given inner peace in response. It's a boomerang effect. The Torah tells us, Hashem Tzilcha, God is your shadow. And if you watch what happens when you move, your shadow follows you. And the rabbis teach that that is the relationship that we have with God. That God acts directly proportionally to the way we act. So if I am concerned about, maybe I don't really take care of myself that well. Maybe I don't really spend enough time trying to cultivate inner peace for myself. Maybe I'm afraid of how difficult it's going to be. Maybe I'm lazy. We're lazy about a lot of important things in life. But all of us have a tendency to at least be concerned about others. Many of us will do for other people things that we don't often bother doing for ourselves. So we're told here in this last example that if I am concerned about the inner peace of others, and I work and expend energy in trying to give other people inner peace, there will be a boomerang effect, and God will grant us as a reward inner peace. I'll just share with you one final observation that the Ba'alei Musar, the rabbis who were the teachers of Musar, always said that they were really giving Musar to themselves. And I want to really emphasize that really what I was sharing with you tonight were things that I needed to teach myself, and I felt that it would be helpful to share with you as well.
Jews for Judaism hopes that you have found this audio recording to be helpful and informative. Jews for Judaism is an international organization dedicated to countering the multi-million dollar efforts of Christian missionary groups that target Jews, the impact of destructive cults and Eastern religions, and the growing rate of intermarriage that is devastating the Jewish community. Jews for Judaism achieves its goals through one-on-one counseling services and educational programs and materials that connect Jewish people to the spiritual depth, beauty, and wisdom of Judaism. Please contact Jews for Judaism if we can help you. www.jewsforjudaism.ca. Keeping Jews Jewish.